For years, the big question about outer space has been, is there anybody out there? Astrophysicist and best-selling science writer Michio Kaku asks a different question, and it may turn out to be a lot more important. When are we going out there? His premise, as you'll hear us discuss at the beginning of the conversation, is that there are a lot of potential extinction-level events that could make the Earth uninhabitable for humans. If one of those things, like a supervolcano or a new ice age, actually happens, our only way to survive extinction may be to leave the Earth behind and find a new place to call home. All right, the premise is pretty terrifying, so I wanted to summarize that a little bit and ask you a question. Global warming could wipe us out. Weaponized anthrax could wipe us out. Nuclear weapons could wipe us out. A supervolcano in Wyoming could wipe us out. A meteor like the one that killed off the dinosaurs could wipe us out. Population growth could wipe us out. And we're almost certainly going to have another ice age in 10,000 years that could wipe us out. That's all in like the first five pages of the book. How much certainty does science put on all of those things? Like a lot? Like those things are pretty for sure?
Well, it's practically a law of physics that humanity is going to be wiped off the face of the Earth. In 5 billion years, the sun is going to eat up the Earth and will be fried in the atmosphere of the Earth. And that's practically a law of physics. And realize that 99.9% of all species on the Earth have eventually gone extinct. Extinction is the norm. We think of Mother Nature as being nurturing. Well, yes, but Mother Nature can also wipe out entire species. But remember that the dinosaurs didn't have a space program. And because the dinosaurs didn't have a space program, they're not here to talk about it. Well, we are here. We do have a space program. And I think with other physicists and scientists that we need an insurance policy to make sure that we too do not go the way of 99% of all life forms that no longer walk the face of the Earth. And that's why I think we should go into outer space and begin to create settlements there.
So I've thought a lot about this in the context of the Mars expedition in reading the book. And I think the biggest concern I have in the very nearest near term is that this kind of magical thinking is a distraction of focus and resources from very, very immediate concerns like global warming. Do you think these are things to think about today, 10 years from now, 100 years from now? Where do you put these priorities in relation to each other?
Well, first of all, global warming is real. It's not a fiction. By satellites, we can measure the fact that the Earth is indeed heating up. And it's a problem that deserves our attention now, not in the future. Now, I don't think there should be a mad rush to go into outer space. No one is saying that we should drop everything and go on to Mars. No, we got to get our own house in order. But realize that this is going to happen anyway because of the fact that Silicon Valley billionaires are investing, well, their billions of dollars by opening up their checkbooks to create their own spaceports, their own moon rockets, independent of the public treasury. You know, just about 3 weeks ago, millions of people watched the Falcon Heavy being launched online. Why? Why were thousands of people lined up at Cape Canaveral? Because the Falcon Heavy is not an ordinary rocket. It is a moon rocket specifically designed to take astronauts around the moon in the Dragon capsule. Not only that, but it's reusable. The booster rockets landed back on the planet Earth, and you can reuse them, dropping the cost of space travel maybe by a factor of 10. And the biggest surprise is it was funded by private enterprise. The public didn't pay one dime, not one dime, for this moon rocket. This means that the cost of space travel is dropping like a rock. You know that the movie The Martian, starring Matt Damon, That movie cost over $100 million, more than the Indian mission to Mars 3 years ago. You realize that Hollywood movies now are more expensive than the actual launching of missiles to Mars. They ought to give the Oscar for the best supporting space probe to the space program.
But I guess, there's public and private sort of investment questions, and I understand that, but to what end? I mean, we get to Mars and what? I mean, if we've spent $100 million or $50 million or whatever the amount is on the next Mars mission, is that a resource allocation, whether it's public or private dollars, is that a resource allocation that wouldn't better be made for the future of humanity on something else?
Well, you could argue that back in the 1960s, in 1966, the NASA budget was 5% of the federal budget. That is astounding that 5% of every tax dollar went into the moon program. Well, those days are gone because that was not sustainable. Now the NASA budget is 0.5% of the federal budget. And on that budget, coupled with private enterprise, we're not talking about a crash program, but with the existing budget, we can now go back to the moon and on to Mars. In fact, it's official. The President of the United States has signed an executive order saying that NASA will no longer be the agency to nowhere. It's going to go someplace, specifically the moon, then Mars and beyond. Starting when? Starting next year.
And you think that's a good idea?
I think it's a good idea because, once again, we're not talking about draining the federal economy. We're not talking about taking food out of the mouths of young people. This is the normal NASA budget. It's not a crash program, but now we have Jeff Bezos, richest man on the earth, starting up his own spaceport in Texas with a fleet of rockets of his own design. We have Elon Musk dreaming of being a multi-planet species, funding his own moon rocket. So this is going to happen anyway. The Chinese are now jumping into the game. They've announced that, yes, they want to put Chinese astronauts on the moon to plant the Chinese flag on the moon. And the Indians, as I mentioned before, launched a successful space probe to Mars for a pittance, $70 million, less than a Hollywood movie. So we have to not think the way of the 1960s. In the 1960s, you could really say that you're taking food right out of the mouths of poor people and putting it into the space program. That was valid back then. Now it's different. We're not talking about doubling NASA's budget. No, NASA's budget, if anything, has decreased a bit. But we're talking about a partnership with private enterprise that has reinvigorated this whole search for life in outer space and one day perhaps to find a home in outer space.
When was the last time we went to the moon? Was it 1969 or have we been back since then?
Well, 1969 was when we had the Apollo mission that first went to the moon. And once again, after several successful launches to the moon, because the wind and the sails was the Cold War, we stopped going to the moon. The Vietnam War then began to consume most of the budget. So where did the Apollo money go? It went to the Vietnam War, basically. And so people lost interest in space exploration because it was too expensive. Well, times have changed. Now we have used missile rockets. We're talking about just like the used car industry. After World War II, a lot of GIs came back from the war penniless, but they dreamed about owning their own car. Then the used car market started, which is now bigger than the new car market, and that changed American culture. All of a sudden, teenagers could have cars. Same thing with rockets. We're not talking about dropping the cost of rockets by a factor of 10 with reusable rockets that can be used over and over and over again. So we're entering a new golden age of space exploration. A new golden age that does not require us to increase the NASA budget. A new golden age that is being foot the bill comes from private enterprise. So I think this is a bargain.
Are there practical reasons to go back to the moon in terms of resources? Or I think there's a series called Destination Moon on Curiosity Stream that talks about using the moon as kind of a halfway house between the Earth and other exploration, is that the main thing we would want from the moon, is a lower gravity base of operations?
Well, first of all, we are going back to the moon. It is now official, whether people like it or not. December 2019, next year, we're going to send the SLS booster rocket, which was funded by taxpayers' money, NASA's rocket, to the moon with the Orion space capsule. So we have not one, but two functioning moon rockets. This is incredible. This is unparalleled. Two functioning moon rockets capable of sending our astronauts to the moon. Now, as far as economics are concerned, first of all, the asteroids. NASA had a plan called Asteroid Redirect that was initially funded. It was to grab an asteroid, maybe about 50 feet across, and bring it back to the Earth or to the moon and harvest it for rare earth elements. It'd be worth on the order of $50 billion. Billionaires in the making if you could begin the process of mining asteroids. Now, also, even the 1960s forced us to miniaturize computers to fit in the nose cone of the Apollo spacecraft. And that led to the iPhone. Why do we have all these miracles in our living room that are so compact, so tiny? And the reason is the space program, because that forced us to miniaturize everything so that we could put them in a space capsule. Now people are saying that we're going to miniaturize once again, going to Mars, and a new generation of computers are going to emerge, which are going to reinvigorate the economy. You realize that trillions of dollars of the economy are due to these miniature transistors brought to you by the space program. So if you were to take away the space program of the 1960s, you can forget the iPhone, you can forget the internet, you can forget all the wonders of modern technology. And now people foresee perhaps a second computer revolution as a consequence.
So that's an argument of applied science versus pure science, that there's a pure science component to space travel.
That's right. We should do both. We should do pure science as well as applied science. But realize that the transistor itself came out of pure science. The people who invented the transistor, three physicists who won the Nobel Prize, thought that maybe we could use it to signal ships at sea using transistors. So they underestimated the power of their creation by a factor of several hundred trillion.
Is it likelier with Mars that we would figure out a way to survive there, notwithstanding the atmosphere, or that we would change the atmosphere to make it breathable and habitable?
Well, in the short term, to create a first settlement on Mars, we would A, have to use lava tubes to create a Mars base. B, we would have to mine the ice to extract out drinking water and oxygen and hydrogen, oxygen for breathing and hydrogen for rocket fuel. And then C, we would have to create an agriculture, genetically modified plants that would thrive in the harsh Martian atmosphere, leading up to one day, decades and decades from now, terraforming Mars. And how would you do that? Satellites. Satellites that orbit around Mars that redirect sunlight onto the ice caps of Mars. You realize that Mars once had an ocean as big as the United States of America. It had seas, it had rivers. And so by melting the ice caps, you could once again make the riverbeds full of water. But of course, that would be for the next century of astronauts.
And something we would largely do with robots. We would send machines that we would control from Earth that would do most of this work.
That's right. We've all seen movies like Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where they have these gorgeous domed cities of glass and steel on the moon. Well, that's all nice. However, who's going to build it? Where's the building material going to come from? That means we have to start to mine the Martian soil to create the materials to create a city on Mars. And the easiest way to do that is with robots. With robots, you could begin the process of constructing entire cities without endangering the lives of astronauts. So the heavy lifting will, in fact, be done by robots. And remember, decades from now, robots are going to be hundreds of times more intelligent than they are today. Robots today, by the way, a robot worker would have the intelligence today of a cockroach. They can barely walk across the room. That's the state of robotics today. However, by the end of the century, we may have robots as smart as maybe a monkey that could roam the countryside, size up the situation, and begin construction work like a construction worker.
I saw one the other day on YouTube. You've probably seen this clip that could open. It looked like a dog. It could open a door and then use its elbow to prop the door open and then walk through it. It was pretty frightening.
Yeah, but also very primitive. Like I said, the most advanced robots we have today have the intelligence of a cockroach, a retarded, lobotomized cockroach. They're very stupid, these robots. But I can imagine that, yeah, by the end of the century, they'll be probably as smart as a dog or maybe as smart as a monkey. So they're not going to replace humans anytime soon.
Well, I really appreciate you talking to me. It's a fascinating book. Thank you.